Now, last year, being the centenary of the First World War, saw the publication of a deluge of poetry written during that war. No shortage of Owen or Sassoon or Rosenberg or Graves or Edward Thomas, quite rightly, even Ivor Gurney. Not much sign of Rupert Brooke, let alone French or Italian or German or women poets. It was very much an image of the First World War conditioned by that anthology that I'm sure almost everybody in this room owns, The Penguin Up the Line to Death, the excellent anthology selected by Brian Gardner in 1964 with its introduction by Edmund Blunden. Here at Ledbury, you, many of you, familiar faces, will recall we did an event, Michael and I and Harriet Walter, did an event based on, not based on, totally dependent on Neil Astley's wonderful anthology called 100 Years War. A fantastic anthology which did everything that the British press failed to do last year and had Russian and Italian and French and German and civilian. And it's a really great anthology and you can still get it, so do get it. Is it at the back or not? It ought to be, but if you don't, if it's not, go and get it because it's in the shop. Great, it's a fantastic anthology, as Blood Acts do tend to be rather fantastic anthologies. So we hope today to give a slightly different perspective on that terrible conflict. I thought there was too much in the press, not in Neil's anthology, too much emphasis on the greats, on Owen and I wanted to look at the different perspective on the First World War. 37 million people died, by focusing on the first year of the war, 1915, putting the poetry written then on both sides and by civilians and observers in a slightly wider political and military context. When war was declared on 28th of July 1914, very few people thought that it would last very long. Recent conflicts have been pretty short-lived. The Franco-Prussian War of 1870 and 71 was just 9 months. It was generally assumed that this conflict would be a similar sort. Cavalry, infantry, with the addition of heavy guns. For that purpose, the British Army amazingly bought 165,000 horses, mainly hunters and cart horses. They saw it as going to be a 19th century war, and in the first 2 days of the war, 30% of those horses were mown down by machine guns. Poets shared that slightly optimistic, slightly romantic, old-fashioned view as follows.
John Freeman was 34 at the outbreak of the war. He became CEO of the Department of Health and Insurance. This poem is called Happy Is England Now. There is not anything more wonderful than a great people moving towards the deep of an unguessed and unfeared future. Nor is aught so dear of all held dear before as the new passion stirring in their veins when the destroying dragon wakes from sleep. Happy is England now as never yet. And though the sorrows of the slow days fret her faithfulest children, grief itself is proud. Even the warm beauty of this spring and summer that turns to bitterness turns then to gladness, since for this England the beloved ones died. Happy is England in the brave that die for wrongs not hers and wrongs so sternly hers. Happy in those that give, and endure the pain that never the new years may cure. Happy in all her dark woods, green fields, towns, her hills and rivers and her chafing sea. Whate'er was dear before is dearer now. There's not a bird singing upon his bough but sings the sweeter in our English ears. There's not a nobleness of heart, hand, brain but shines the purer. Happiest is England now in those that fight and watch with pride and tears. Lawrence Binion worked in the British Museum in the Oriental Prints and Drawings. Best known for his For the Fallen, read at every November the 11th memorial, and written, surprisingly, at the start of the war. Now in thy splendour go before us, Spirit of England, ardent-eyed, enkindle this dear earth that bore us, in the hour of peril purified. The cares we hugged drop out of vision, our hearts with deeper thought dilate. We step from days of sour division into the grandeur of our fate. For us the glorious dead have striven, they battled that we might be free. We to their living cause are given, we arm for men that are to be. Among the nations nobliest chartered, England recalls her heritage. In her is that which is not bartered, which force can neither quell nor cage. For her immortal stars are burning, with her the hope that's never done, the seed that's in the springs returning, the very flower that seeks the sun. She fights the force that feeds desire on, dreams of a prey to seize and kill, the barren creed of blood and iron, vampire of Europe's wasted will. Endure, O earth, and thou awaken, purged by this dreadful winnowing, fan, O wronged, untamable, unshaken soul of divinely suffering man. W. N. Hodgson was a friend of Rupert Brooke's. He was aged only 21 at the start of the war. He served in France and won the MC, but he was killed on the first day of the Somme, July the 1st, 1916. Sons of mine, I hear you thrilling to the trumpet call of war. Gird ye then, I give you freely, as I give your sires before. All the noblest of the children I in love and anguish bore. Free in service, wise in justice, fearing but dishonor's breath. Steel to suffer uncomplaining, loss of failure, pain of death. Strong in faith which sees the issue, and in hope that triumpheth. Go and may the God of battles you in his good guidance keep. And if he wisdom giveth unto his beloved sleep, I accept nothing asking save a little space to weep. And I should have said that the title of that poem is England to Her Sons. Now Thomas Hardy, who needs no introduction, wrote this, Men Who March Away. What of the faith and fire within us, men who march away, ere the barn cock say, night is growing grey, to hazards whence no tears can win us? What of the faith and fire within us, men who march away? Is it a purblind prank, O think you, friend with a musing eye, who watch us stepping by, with doubt and dolorous sigh? Can much pondering so hoodwink you? Is it a purblind prank, O think you, friend with a musing eye? Nay, we see well what we are doing, though some may not see, dalliers as they be, England's need are we. Her distress would leave us ruing. Nay, we well see what we are doing, though some may not see. In our heart of hearts, believing victory crowns the just, and that braggarts must surely bite the dust, press we to the field ungrieving, in our heart of hearts believing, victory crowns the just. Hence the faith and fire within us, men who march away, ere the barn cock say, night is growing grey, leaving all that here can win us. Hence the faith and fire within us, men who march away.
Hard to hear those poems, isn't it, without ironically hearing Joan Littlewood's a much more satirical look at the whole thing. But Hardy, to be fair to him, did hear darker rumblings.
This is called channel firing. That night your great guns, unawares, shook all our coffins as we lay, and broke the chancel window squares. We thought it was the judgment day, and sat upright, while drearisome arose the howl of wakened hounds. The mouse let fall the altar crumb. The worms drew back into the mounds. The glebe cow drooled, till God called, no, it's gunnery practice out at sea. just as before you went below. The world is as it used to be. All nations striving strong to make red war yet redder. Mad as hatters, they do no more for Christ's sake than you who are helpless in such matters. That this is not the judgment hour for some of them is a blessed thing. For if it were, they'd have to scour hell's floor for so much threatening. Aha! It will be warmer when I blow the trumpet, if indeed I ever do, for you are men, and rest eternal sorely need. So down we lay again. I wonder, will the world ever saner be, said one, than when he sent us under in our indifferent century? And many a skeleton shook his head. Instead of preaching 40 years, my neighbour Parson Thirdly said, I wish I'd stuck to pipes and beer. Again the guns disturbed the hour, roaring their readiness to avenge, as far inland as Stourton Tower and Camelot and starlit Stonehenge.
But even though he could hear those rumblings, I don't think he had a first idea about what was coming and what men were marching blithely towards. But there were wonderful bring-up poets, Charles Sawley, for instance.
Charles Sawley, who was only 19 in 1914, a scholar at Oxford. He enlisted in the Suffolk Regiment and was made a captain, but he was killed at Loos in 1915. He was thought by Masefield to be the best of all the war poets. He wrote, apologising for his handwriting being hurried and angular, and his poems unfinished, I've had no time for the final touch, nor seem likely to have for some time. This is called All the Hills and Vales Along, in part. All the hills and vales along, earth is bursting into song, and the singers are the chaps who are going to die, perhaps. Oh, sing, marching men, till the valleys ring again. Give your gladness to earth's keeping, so be glad when you are sleeping. From the hills and valleys, earth shouts back the sound of mirth, tramp of feet and lilt of song, ringing all the road along. All the music of their going, ringing, swinging, glad song throwing, earth will echo still when foot lies numb and voice mute. On marching men, on to the gates of death with song. Sow your gladness for earth's reaping, so you may be glad though sleeping. Strew your gladness on earth's bed, so be merry, so be dead. Julian Grenfell was educated at Eton and Oxford, and he was a regular officer in the Royal Dragoons since 1910. He was awarded the DSO, and he sent this poem into battle home in the form of a letter. It was published in the Times. A few weeks later, he died of his wounds. The naked earth is warm with spring, and with green grass and bursting trees leans to the sun's gaze glorying and quivers in the sunny breeze. And life is colour and warmth and light and a striving evermore for these. And he is dead who will not fight, and who dies fighting has increase. The fighting man shall from the sun take warmth and life from glowing earth, speed with the lightfoot winds to run, and with the trees to newer birth, and find when fighting shall be done, great rest and fullness after dearth. All the bright company of heaven hold him in their bright comradeship, the dog star and the sisters seven, Orion's belt and sworded hip, the woodland trees that stand together, they stand to him each one a friend. They gently speak in the windy weather, they guide to valley and ridge's end. The kestrel hovering by day and the little owls that call by night bid him be swift and keen as they, as keen of ear, as swift of sight. The blackbird sings to him, brother, brother, if this be the last song you shall sing, sing well, for you may not sing another. Brother, sing. In dreary, doubtful waiting hours, before the brazen frenzy starts, the horses show him nobler powers, O patient eyes, courageous hearts. And when the burning moment breaks, and all things else are out of mind, and only joy of battle takes him by the throat and makes him blind. Through joy and blindness he shall know, not caring much to know, that still nor lead nor steel shall reach him so that it be not the destined will. The thundering line of battle stands, and in the air death moans and sings. But day shall clasp him with strong hands, and night shall fold him in soft wings. Leslie Coulson was a journalist before the war. He was wounded at Gallipoli. A platoon sergeant, he was sent to France, where he was killed in action at the Somme, aged 27, and this poem is called From the Somme. In other days, I sang of simple things, of summer dawn and summer noon and night, the dewy grass, the dew-wet fairy rings, the lark's long golden flight. Deep in the forest, I made melody while squirrels cracked their hazelnuts on high. Or I would cross the wet sand to the sea and sing to sea and sky. When came the silvered silence of the night, I stole to casements over scented lawns and softly sang of love and love's delight to mute white marble fawns. Oft in the tavern parlour I would sing of morning sun upon the mountain vine and, calling for a chorus, sweep the string in praise of good red wine. I played with all the toys the gods provide. I sang my songs and made good holiday. Now I have cast my broken toys aside and flung my lute away. A singer once, I now am fain to weep. Within my soul I feel strange music swell. Vast chants of tragedy, too deep for my poor lips to tell. Alfred Lichtenstein wrote this next poem called Leaving from the Front. He was a Prussian Jew who was doing compulsory military service when war was declared. He was sent to the Western Front, where he was immediately wounded and died soon afterwards. Before I die, I must just find this rhyme. Be quiet, my friends, and do not waste my time. We're marching off in company with death. I only wish my girl would hold her breath. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm glad to leave. Now mother's crying too. There's no reprieve. And now look how the suns begin to set. A nice mass grave is all that I shall get. Once more the good old sunset's glowing red. In 13 days I'll probably be dead.
French and German poets realized rather more quickly than English poets that this conflict was something very different. In 3 days in August, 40,000 French soldiers were killed. By the end of the month, 75,000 were dead.
Peter Baum was a stretcher bearer on the Western Front. He was digging graves when he was hit by shrapnel in June 1916. He died the following day. His poem is called At the Beginning of the War. At the beginning of the war, there was a rainbow. Birds black wheeled against grey clouds. Pigeons shone silver as on their circular journey they turned through a narrow strip of sunlight. Battle takes place hard by battle. They lied like troopers. Row upon row of stoved-in heads fill one with horror. Shells often explode as they tumble on, beginning to lose velocity. The shell's pain bow grows all the time. Caught between death and the bow of peace, they clutch their rifle barrels more firmly to defend their homeland, spitting at the enemy, leaning on one another as they totter, tumbling over hills like waves of the sea, staggering on, attracted magnetically by death. Wilhelm Klemm was a doctor in Van Housen's Third Army, and he served throughout the war. His publishing houses were destroyed by Allied bombing in 1943, the same year as his two sons were killed. And this poem is called Clearing Station. Straw rustling everywhere. The candle stumps stand there, staring solemnly. Across the nocturnal vault of the church, moans go drifting and choking words. There's a stench of blood, pus, shit, and sweat. Bandages ooze away underneath torn uniforms. Clammy, trembling hands and wasted faces. Bodies stay propped up as their dying heads slump down. In the distance, the battle thunders grimly on. Day and night, groaning and grumbling non-stop. And to the dying men patiently waiting for their graves, it sounds for all the world like the words of God. Now, Cécile Perrin was a French poet who died in 1959, aged 82. And this poem is called Wartime April. The north wind whistling round the doors, snow filling the lanes and tracks with white. Wartime April, April caught and pinioned with a gale's lash, April of the stricken light. The women wear black veils, the girls a grown-up dignity. The talk is in murmurs. Night closes in, silence. A splinter of hope gleams in the dark like driftwood. Here we sit. No one speaking now. What do you say to a woman crying? Here we sit like prisoners, never stirring, each in her house. We sit and know the men are dying. This is a poem called All Souls' Day, which was written by Lucy de la Rue Madras, who was a writer and a sculptor. Public mourning, unconsoled, a landscape hunching drab and bare among the plundering flames of autumn, bells tolling, guns thunder rolling. All Souls' Day, day of graveside prayer, bells tolling, guns thunder rolling, our wearing hearts grown dull and numb to bells, the alarms, and everywhere. Entire tragedies of lives undone. In the sad, soft wind we feel brush round us as we kneel, dead leaves and sundered souls. At last the bells pause for breath, but not the drumming, willing guns while we are celebrating death. The distance dins with killing, killing. And this next one is a poem by André Martel called Execution. Martel, who survived the war and became secretary to the artist Jean Dubuffet. Itching all night long, it's never ended. Stem the evil of the scratch. In a shirt seam where they hatch, one of the scoundrels is apprehended. The time has come. Let justice be enacted in all its rigor, with all speed. Against such unrepentant greed, humanity has suddenly reacted. Louse, your bliss was brief as mayfly's breath. The verdict's quick, no pity is expressed. The perpetrator is condemned to death, and fingernail to fingernail is pressed. A bit like us, as the war grinds on, one sharp crack, you're gone. Giuseppe Ungaretti was an infantryman on the Western Front who started writing poems on his first day in the trenches. After the war, in fact, he became one of Italy's greatest modernist poets. This is called Vigil. An entire night, thrown down beside a butchered companion, with his grimacing mouth turned to the full moon, with his congested hands thrust into my silence, I wrote letters full of love. I have never held so hard to life.
Here at home, some people did understand. It was easier to understand if you were observing. And, of course, Edward Thomas, who was too old or older enough not to have to enlist, he was watching, and you remember he was very uncertain about, indecisive about whether he was going to enlist. So here is his poem.
This is no case of petty right or wrong that politicians or philosophers can judge. I hate not Germans, nor grow hot with love of Englishmen to please newspapers. Beside my hate for one fat patriot, my hatred of the Kaiser is love true. A kind of god he is, banging a gong. But I have not to choose between the two, or between justice and injustice. Dinned with war and argument, I read no more than in the storm, smoking along the wind athwart the wood. Two witches' cauldrons roar. From one the weather shall rise clear and gay, out of the other an England beautiful, and like her mother that died yesterday. Little I know or care if, being dull, I shall miss something that historians can rake out of the ashes when perchance the phoenix broods serene above their ken. But with the best and meanest Englishmen, I am one in crying, God save England, lest we lose what never slaves and cattle blessed. The ages made her that made us from dust. She's all we know and live by, and we trust she's good and must endure loving her so. And as we love ourselves, we hate our foe.
Those actually doing the fighting over in Europe did begin to realise that this was no 19th century war. John Drinkwater.
John Drinkwater, yes, was a teacher who in fact became an actor, and he worked in Barry Jackson's Birmingham Rep Company throughout the war. The poem's called 1915. On a ploughland hill against the sky, over the barley, over the rye, time, which is now a black pine tree, holds out his arms and mocks at me. In the year of your Lord 1915, the acres are ploughed and the acres are green, and the calves and the lambs and the foals are born, but man, the angel, is all forlorn. The cropping cattle, the swallow's wing, the wagon team and the pasture spring move in their seasons and are most wise. But man, whose image is in the skies, who is master of all, whose hand achieves the church and the barn and the homestead eaves, how are the works of his wisdom seen in the year of your Lord, 1915? Now, an Irish poet, Francis Ledwidge, who was a protege of Edward Marsh, he was killed in action in July 1917. When I was young, I had a care, lest I should cheat me of my share, of that which makes it sweet to strive for life and dying still survive. A name in sunshine written higher than lark or poet dare aspire. But I grew weary doing well. Besides, 'twas sweeter in that hell, down with the loud banditti people who robbed the orchards, climbed the steeple for jackdaw's eyes, and made the cock crow ere 'twas daylight on the clock. I was so very bad, the neighbours spoke of me at their daily labours. Now I'm drinking wine in France, the helpless child of circumstance. Tomorrow will be loud with war. How will I be accounted for? It is too late now to retrieve a fallen dream, too late to grieve a name unmade, but not too late to thank the gods for what is great. A keen-edged sword, a soldier's heart, is greater than a poet's art, and greater than a poet's fame, a little grave that has no name. And now a Canadian poet and a doctor, John McCrae, who went to Europe as a gunner. He was appointed consultant to all the British armies in France, but died of pneumonia before taking up the post. Famously, he wrote In Flanders Fields, which was published anonymously in Punch and became the most famous poem of the war. In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. Now, E.A. McIntosh, a poem called Recruiting. McIntosh, who left Oxford to join the Seaforth Highlanders. He was wounded and gassed in the Somme and awarded the MC. He returned to France in 1917 and was killed at Cambrai. Lads, you're wanted. Go and help. On the railway carriage wall stuck the poster, and I thought of the hands that penned the call. Fat civilians, wishing they could go out and fight the Hun. Can't you see them thanking God that they're over 41? Girls with feathers, vulgar songs, washy verse on England's need. And God, don't we damned well know how the message ought to read? Lads, you're wanted, over there, shiver in the morning dew. More poor devils like yourselves waiting to be killed by you. Go and help to swell the names in the casualty lists. Help to make a column stuff for the blasted journalists. Help to keep them nice and safe from the wicked German foe. Don't let him come over here. Lads, you're wanted. Out you go. There's a better word than that, lads, and can't you hear it come from a million men that call you to share their martyrdom? Leave the harlots still to sing comic songs about the Hun. Leave the fat old men to say, now we've got them on the run. Better 20 honest years than their dull 70. Lads, you're wanted. Come and learn to live and die with honest men. You shall learn what men can do if you will but pay the price. Learn the gaiety and strength in the gallant sacrifice. Take your risk of life and death underneath the open sky. Live clean or go out quick. Lads, you're wanted. Come and die.
Things began to go wrong. The death row climbed. Such fine poets as Julian Grenfell, who you've just heard, and his younger brother, Billy, who many considered even more talented. They were killed. Charles Sawley died early. Vera Brittain, who's Shirley Williams' mother's, her fiancé, Roland Leighton, was also killed in this first year of the war. Poor Rupert Brooke died even before he actually got to fight at Gallipoli. So the government was trying to open up new fronts and fighting at sea, and here is Rudyard Kipling on Jutland.
Yes, Kipling, who'd won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1907, his only son Jack was killed in action at Loos. He refused the poet laureateship 3 times. Not in the thick of the fight, not in the press of the odds, do the heroes come to their height, or we know the demigods that stand still over peace. We can only perceive men return from the seas, very grateful for leave. They grant us sudden days, snatched from their business of war, but we are too close to appraise what manner of men they are. And whether their names go down with age-kept victories, or whether they battle and drown, unreckoned is hid from our eyes. They are too near to be great, but our children shall understand when and how our fate was changed and by whose hand. Our children shall measure their worth. We are content to be blind, but we know that we walk on a newborn earth with the saviours of mankind.
To break the growing deadlock and open up a new front, Winston Churchill, who was the first Lord of the Admiralty, tried to outflank the Germans in the east by securing the Dardanelles at Gallipoli. It was poorly conceived, poorly executed, poorly equipped, and poorly led. The British Navy sent 6 old, pretty much disused battleships. They were seen off pretty easily by the Turkish Navy. A direct assault on the narrow Gallipoli Peninsula that was only 10 miles by 45 on the 25th of April secured a foothold, but the Turks fought back hand-to-hand with bayonets and were successful. The whole thing was a complete disaster. 130,000 British troops from Australia, New Zealand, India, what was then Ceylon, all died. The 5th Norfolks were almost totally eliminated. The Lancashire Fusiliers fought heroically and were rewarded 6 VCs in the conflict, but in Bay. Here are 2 poems, the first by A.P. Herbert, which observes before the battle really commences, and then a rather unusual poem by an Australian, Sidney Bolitho, that is not a great poem, but it says, it describes, and perhaps when you heard it, it describes what happened and explains why the Australians now put such enormous store on Gallipoli.
A.P. Herbert's is called The Bathe. Come, friend, and swim. We may be better then, but here the dust blows ever in the eyes, and wrangling round are the weary, fevered men, forever made with flies. I cannot sleep, nor even long lie still, and you have read your April paper twice. Tomorrow we must stagger up the hill to man a trench and live among the lice. But yonder, where the Indians have their goats, there is a rock stands sheer above the blue, where one may sit and count the bustling boats and breathe the cool air through. May find it still is good to be alive, may look across and see the Trojan shore, twinkling and warm, may strip and stretch and dive, and for a space forget about the war. Then will we sit and talk of happy things, home and the high and some far-fighting friend, and gather strength for what the morrow brings, for that may be the end. It may be we shall never swim again, never be clean and comely to the sight, may rot untombed and stink with all the slain. Come then and swim. Come and be clean tonight. And here's the Sidney Bolitho part of it, called Gallipoli. The new dawn lights the eastern sky. Nightshades are lifted from the sea. The 3rd Brigade with courage storm thy wooded heights, Gallipoli. Gallipoli, Gallipoli, Australians tread Gallipoli. Thunderous bursts from iron mouths, myriad messengers of death. Warships ply their deadly fire, watching comrades hold their breath. Gallipoli, Gallipoli, there's hell upon Gallipoli. Serried ranks upon the beach, courage beams in every eye. These Australian lads can face giant death, though e'er so nigh. Gallipoli, Gallipoli, there's death upon Gallipoli. For those brave hearts that die to show Australia's worth in this dread war, the far-off tears and sighs for those who sleep beneath the cannon's roar, Gallipoli, Gallipoli, thou still shalt pay, Gallipoli. Upon the graves of those that sleep, upon thy wooded slope and vale, we shall avenge. Remember then, Australians cannot, will not fail. Gallipoli, Gallipoli, thick dead die on Gallipoli. For days they hold with grim set grip, their feet firm planted on the shore, repelling every fierce attack, and cheerfully they seek for more. Gallipoli, Gallipoli, their trenches line Gallipoli. Gallipoli, Gallipoli, thy doom is sealed, Gallipoli.
It was a complete disaster, and not surprisingly, Churchill resigned in disgrace. It is extraordinary that in a short period between that moment and 39, he could reform his career and his reputation. But he resigned, and here at home, the Germans deployed the first Zeppelins. Initially, it's extraordinary to think back, the Kaiser, in a last sort of flicker of 19th century, not chivalry exactly, but niceness, insisted that bombs should not be dropped on London. They soon changed that policy.
2 poems. The first one by Wilfred Gibson, who was a social worker in the East End, who became one of Rupert Brooke's closest friends and a protege of Edward Marsh. He served in the ranks in 1914 and survived the war, dying in 1962. And that's followed by a poem by Lawrence Binion, once again, called The Zeppelin. Gibson's is called Air Raid. Night shatters in mid-heaven. The bark of guns, the roar of planes, the crash of bombs, and all the unshackled sky pandemonium stuns the senses to indifference. When a fall of masonry nearby startles awake, tingling, wide-eyed, prick-eared, with bristling hair, each sense within the body crouched aware like some sore-hunted creature in the brake. Yet side by side we lie in the little room, just touching hands, with eyes and ears that strain keenly, yet dream-bewildered through tense gloom, listening in helpless stupor of insane, drugged nightmare panic, fantastically wild, to the quiet breathing of our little child. And now the Binion Zeppelin. Guns, far and near, quick, sudden, angry, they startle the still street. Upturned faces appear, doors open on darkness, there's a hurrying of feet, and whirled athwart gloom, white fingers of alarm point at last there where, illumined and dumb, a shape suspended hovers, a demon of the starry air. Strange and cold as a dream of sinister fancy, it charms like a snake, poised deadly in a gleam, while bright explosions leap up to it and break. Is it terror you seek to exult in? Know then, hearts are here, that the plunging beak of night-winged murder strikes not with fear. So much as it stings to a deep elation and a quivering pride, that at last the hour brings for them too the danger of those who died, of those who yet fight, spending for each of us their glorious blood in the foreign night, that now we are near to them, thank we God.
On the ground, the Battle of the Marne was inconclusive, and trench warfare, which is our great image of that war, ensued, and both sides were snared in the trenches.
This is a poem by Albert Paul Granier, translated from the French, of course. It's called Nocturne. The guns have fallen silent, gagged with fog, in the winter's night that cancels space, and a calm full of menace as the screech of owls over castle walls hangs in the many-hearted silence. Sentries peering out, tense every muscle, edgily awaiting the unexpected. A thwack like wet cloth sounds from the valley. Sudden, muffled rifle shots, unsure of Gestad shadows and the rustling emptiness. Tonight is like the nights in Breton legend, when hell-hag washerwomen kneel invisible at riverside stones, beating shrouds in the thick water. And another poem by Charles Sawley, called When You See Millions of the Mouthless Dead. When you see millions of the mouthless dead across your dreams in pale battalions go, say not soft things, as other men have said, that you'll remember, for you need not so. Give them not praise, for deaf, how should they know it is not curses heaped on each gashed head, nor tears, their blind eyes see not your tears flow, nor honour, it is easy to be dead. Say only this, they are dead. Then add thereto, yet many a better one has died before. And this is a poem by Richard Aldington, who was an imagist, a friend of T.E. Hume's and of Ezra Pound, and he was gassed on the Western Front. It's called Bombardment. 4 days the earth was rent and torn by bursting steel. The houses fell about us. 3 nights we dared not sleep, sweating and listening for the imminent crash which meant our death. The 4th night, every man, nerve-tortured, racked to exhaustion, slept, muttering and twitching, while the shells crashed overhead. The 5th day there came a hush. We left our holes and looked above the wreckage of the earth to where the white clouds moved in silent lines across the untroubled blue. another poem by Wilfred Gibson, simply called Mad. Neck deep in mud, he mowed and raved, he who had braved the field of blood, and as a lad just out of school, yelled April Fool and laughed like mad. Here's a poem called The Deserter by Gilbert Franco. I'm sorry I done it, Major. We bandaged the livid face and led him out ere the wan sun rose to die his death of disgrace. The bolt heads locked to the cartridge, the rifles steadied to rest, as cold stock nestled at colder cheek and foresight lined on the breast. Fire! Called the Sergeant Major. The muzzles flamed as he spoke, and the shameless soul of a nameless man went up in the cordite smoke. And another short one by Wilfred Gibson, called In the Ambulance. Two rows of cabbages, two of curly greens, two rows of early peas, two of kidney beans. That's what he keeps muttering, making such a song, keeping other chaps awake the whole night long. Both his legs are shot away, and his head is light, so he keeps on muttering all the blessed night. Two rows of cabbages, two of curly greens, two rows of early peas, two of kidney beans. And so the war grinds on. It's a poem by Robert Palmer, who was the second son of Lord Selborne. Brilliant scholar at Oxford, called to the bar in 1913 and predicted to become Lord Chancellor had he lived. He joined up in 1914, served in Mesopotamia, and was killed in 1916. This is called How Long, O Lord? How long, O Lord, how long before the flood of crimson welling carnage shall abate? From sodden plains in west and east, the blood of kindly men streams up in mists of hate, polluting thy clean air. And nations great in reputation of the arts that bind the world with hopes of heaven sink to the state of brute barbarians, whose ferocious mind gloats o'er the bloody havoc of their kind, not knowing love or mercy. Lord, how long shall Satan in high places lead the blind to battle for the passions of the strong? O touch thy children's hearts, that they may know hate their most hateful, pride their deadliest foe. And this is a poem by Maurice Baring, who came from Eton and Trinity, Cambridge, was another protege of Marsh's. He joined the Foreign Office and was in intelligence. It's called August 1918, and it's set in a French village. I hear the tinkling of the cattle bell in the broad stillness of the afternoon. High in the cloudless haze, the harvest moon is pallid as the phantom of a shell. A girl is drawing water from a well. I hear the clatter of her wooden shoe. Two mothers to their sleeping babies croon, and the hot village feels the drowsy spell. Sleep, child, the angel of death his wings has spread. His engines scour the land, the sea, the sky, and all the weapons of hell's armory are ready for the blood that is their bread. And many a thousand men tonight must die, so many that they will not count the dead. Siegfried Sassoon won the MC at the Somme. He was in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, like Robert Graves, and eventually he was hospitalised with Wilfred Owen. He and Owen unsparingly described the full horrors and idiocies of the war, and he came to be the acknowledged leader of the war poets. This is called Died of Wounds. His wet white face and miserable eyes brought nurses to him more than groans and sighs. But hoarse and low and rapid rose and fell his troubled voice. He did the business well. The ward grew dark, but he was still complaining and called out for Dickie. Curse the wood, It's time to go. Oh, Christ, and what's the good? We'll never take it, and it's always raining. I wondered where he'd been, then heard him shout, "They snipe like hell. Oh, Dickie, don't go out." I fell asleep. Next morning he was dead, and some slight wound lay smiling on the bed. And this is John McCrae once again, a poem called The Anxious Dead. O guns, fall silent till the dead men hear above their heads the legions pressing on. These fought their fight in time of bitter fear and died not knowing how the day had gone. O flashing muzzles, pause and let them see the coming dawn that streaks the sky afar. Then let your mighty chorus witness be to them and Caesar that we still make war. Tell them, O guns, that we have heard their call, that we have sworn and will not turn aside, that we will onward till we win or fall, that we will keep the faith for which they died. Bid them be patient, and some day anon they shall feel earth enwrapped in silence deep, shall greet in wonderment the quiet dawn, and in content may turn them to their sleep. A poem by Erich Fried called The French Soldiers' Mutiny. For years the troops have gone like lambs to the slaughter, but these are bleating. They are marching through the town. They are marching, and they are bleating like sheep. By bleating, they cease to be a herd of sheep. And this is a poem by Marcel Martinet, who was exempted from military service on health grounds and spent the war in Paris. It's called The Women Say. The women say, yes, of course, it's sad. All those young men. And they don't always receive the best of care. One can't do everything, can one? A friend of ours who did some hospital work, the one with the military cross, told us, oh, it is sad. But even so, if we were to pay attention to that barbouse, that Ladsko, said the other one opposite, oh, no, no, dear, that would be too awful. No, no. If it was as they say, don't you agree, so horrible, we couldn't bear it. We are not so hard-hearted. It's just not possible. Besides, my brother, the captain, writes to say that it's being exaggerated, that there are actually good times, times of enthusiasm, like when they attack, eh? Another cup of tea, dear. We've been able to save a bit of sugar. Jean Cocteau wrote this poem, Then My Guide in the Blue Overcoat. Then my guide in the blue overcoat got down on all fours, like a hunting dog. He went into a hole and gestured for me to follow him. Will the burrow fall in? Will it bury me? My shoulders are in contact with each side. My head emerges into a sort of padded bowl, where two men and my guide are holding out. I absolutely wouldn't hold out. I heard a new sort of silence. For 12 meters from that spot begins the German silence. Between the two of them grows the barbed wire undergrowth where rear up the chevaux de frise. It's the boulevard of death, the killing ground if you walk there, like on the red metro rail. The strip jointly used, the devastating zone, from top of the little periscope towers, the eye perches alone on the sandbags like a blue bird turning its head in all directions. They give it a nickname, Rue de la Paix. Across the whole of Europe, the tradesmen of the left pavement and those of the right pavement keep watch on each other through a tiny window. Then I stretched out my arm in the sap and I tugged on Amet's waterproof. I didn't want to stay there anymore. I couldn't bear this zone made of deceptive gentleness. For the Germans often sing the songs I sang as a child with my brother and sister, O Tannenbaum, le roi des hommes. Amet, how can you want me to hate the Germans? On Tuesday, the Marines at the listening post at Mamelon Vert called out to two Germans in order to have a game of cards. The admiral condemned them to death. We make our way back by dreamed-of Venice, empty Algiers, the Herculaneum of trenches. We come across blue Arabs, men of ashes, blue gondolas. And finally, a poem by Alexander Blok, the Russian symbolist, poet born in 1880, and one of the most celebrated poems of the Russian Revolution. Here the kite predicts disaster, and it possibly summarizes much of our program. The kite. Describing circle after circle, a wheeling kite scans a field lying desolate. In her hovel, a mother's wailing to her child. Come, take my breast, boy. Feed on this. Grow. Know your place. Shoulder the cross. Centuries pass. Villages flame. Are stunned by war and civil war. My country, you are still the same. Tragic. Beautiful as before. In beauty ancient and tear-stained, how long must the mother wail? How long must the kite wheel?